The fields on both sides are so big that it would be really impossible for me to review them all. It's just a universe in which predicting who will come out is always hard. This year, it's particularly hard. I also think that in presidential politics, more than in almost any other kind of race, temperament, character, personality does play a large role.
Good morning. I want to extend a special welcome to some guests in-house here today. The State Farm Regional Office, which has its regional headquarters here in Charlottesville, Dan Shepard, who is head of State Farm's Public Affairs Office, is holding a meeting here with some of their public affairs representatives from around the region. So, Dan, welcome to you and your colleagues. We're glad to have you. Glad to have you here today. Today is the actually our 60th speaker of this year, and we will be starting off again on the 15th of January with a very unusual program, and I'll take 5 seconds to tell you about it. In 1971, a young man named Martin Andrews, who was a teenager at the time, was kidnapped and brutally abused and was left to die for a week, chained in a 4-foot by 4-foot by 8-foot box that was buried underground down in the Portsmouth area. And some hunters who happened through the woods saw the mound of disturbed dirt and were curious, and he, fortunately, even though he'd been terribly beat up, was able to start banging on the side of the box, and they got the sheriff and they saved him. And his attacker was put in jail for 30 years. When the attacker was about to be released from prison 6 years ago, Martin Andrews found out that in some states they have civil commitment proceedings that will hold a sexual predator after he served his prison sentence. And so he went to the General Assembly, went to the governor, and got Virginia to pass that kind of law, and he got appropriations to pay for the incarceration expenses. And so his assailant was held after his sentence was completed and was ultimately killed by another prisoner. And Martin Andrews is going to come on the 15th of January, which is the anniversary of his kidnapping, and is going to tell his story, not only about what happened to him, but about how he, as one deeply interested individual, was able to affect an important change by working. And it's a story of real hope and showing the power of one person to make a change. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is an old friend, Todd Purdom. Todd Purdom graduated from Princeton, and after graduating from Princeton, he went to work for the New York Times, his only employer until about a year and a half ago. He was in the Los Angeles Bureau and then came to Washington and covered the White House during the early years of the Bush administration. He wrote a book called A Time of Our Choosing about the run-up to the war in Iraq. About a year and a half ago, he moved to Vanity Fair, where he is the national political editor of the magazine and has written some major stories, copies of a couple of which have been placed on your seats. Please welcome Todd Purdom.
Thank you, George. It's always a pleasure to be in Charlottesville and here at the Miller Center, partly because it's always a pleasure to get out of Washington to a place where people are talking about real issues, and in a university setting where people have time to think and think about what really matters. I was thinking myself driving down here today how nice it would be if I were coming to Charlottesville in the spring, and then I stepped out of the car and I realized I was coming to Charlottesville in the spring. So. When George asked me to give a preview or overview of the coming campaign year, I was a little bit hesitant, partly because it's all so fluid and it's moving so quickly that whatever I say right now might be out of date by this evening news. But I think that gives me an opportunity, in fact, to reflect a little bit on some longer-term questions. And I just start by saying that 16 years ago tomorrow, my wife went to work for the governor of Arkansas. Her name is Dede Meyers, and his name was Bill Clinton. And his presidential campaign in December 1991 was really just getting underway. She was one of his first hires on December 13th, 1991. At the end of that year, one of the other early hires, Rahm Emanuel, now Congressman Emanuel from Chicago, stood on a desk and unleashed a string of joyous obscenities, which was one of his standard techniques and I think may still be in Congress. And the cause of this was that the Clinton campaign had, in the final quarter of 1991, raised $3.1 million, more than twice its nearest rival. Well, as you know from reading the newspapers, both major Democratic candidates this year expect to raise $100 million each for the primary cycle. In 16 years, I don't know how we got there, and I'm not sure I would call it progress. 10 years ago, when I covered the Clinton White House in the 1996 campaign against Bob Dole, there was no such thing for me on the road as the internet or email. I can't imagine how you could cover a campaign without it now. I can't imagine how you would know what was going on. So the compression and the intensity of campaigning is really phenomenal. And partly in this year, it's because of the open field. Not since 1952, arguably not since 1928, has there been a presidential election in which no vice president or sitting official was contending for the prize. So that has made it fluid and open. The emphasis on technology has obviously also greatly increased the intensity, the sort of 24/7 nature of it. But again, just for comparison purposes, the Iowa caucuses this year will be on January 3rd and the New Hampshire primary on January 8th. When you think back about what the traditional patterns of primaries and caucuses were in terms of the schedule, I was shocked yesterday, and I actually had to look it up, that in 1968, when Lyndon Johnson said he would not run that year for president, he made that declaration on March 31st, 1968, and after Robert Kennedy had got in and after Gene McCarthy had won the New Hampshire primary. The notion that we could actually take something less than 6 months to elect a president seems as distant as the age of clipper ships, but again, I'm not sure it's progress. This year, just by comparison, on February 5th, New York and California, Missouri, Illinois, New Jersey, traditionally states that voted in the case of New Jersey and California as late as June, will all be voting on a single day. And the last big state primary of the whole season will be Texas on March 4th, which used to be the time when the presidential campaign really got rolling. So, part of the question about this crazy situation we're in, I think, involves going back to figure out a little bit how we got here. And it's one of the great sort of laws of unintended consequences and department of what you didn't plan for that helped us get there. Because you'll remember, of course, that the whole evolution of the primary system was meant to take the decisions about nominees away from the party bosses and the smoke-filled rooms and the private understandings and put it in the hands of voters. And the idea was to have a time and a process in which real people all over the country could, state by state and bit by bit, test the candidate, hear the candidate, make judgments about the candidate. That process itself, by the late 1960s, had come to seem closed enough that reforms were put in place after the 1968 campaign, especially on the Democratic side, that made it possible to exploit other avenues of getting early support in the nomination. And one of those, which was figured out, frankly, by Gary Hart and his compatriots who were running the McGovern campaign, was the Iowa caucuses. And a couple of wunderkinds named Gene Picorni and Rick Stearns is now a federal judge in Massachusetts, figured out that caucuses, by their very nature, which they met in small groups in people's homes, in churches or schools, would be more susceptible to early advocacy and, you know, person-to-person visiting than primaries with the faceless voters who went to the polls, you know, one by one all day long. So starting more than a year before, they assiduously tilled the soil of Iowa. They built, basically, they wrote back to everyone who'd written Senator McGovern about his stance on the war from Iowa, and they went, and block by block and town by town, they built what amounted to an organization. And when the Iowa caucuses began that year, everyone thought that Senator Muskie from Maine was the clear favorite. And in fact, in the middle of an ice storm, with windshield temperatures of 50 degrees below zero, that didn't turn out to be the case. And in fact, Senator McGovern finished. I don't think he even finished first, but he made a surprisingly strong showing, and he was pronounced the kind of media winner. So in some ways, the whole thing has from the very beginning been a construct of the national media. It's been a useful way in which people in my trade find a shorthand way to talk about the horse race and what's exciting about it. And it's never had as much to do with the substance of the question as you might have hoped it would have or as it should have. This is only exacerbated by the fact that it's also incredibly sped up now, and the caucuses in this case will take place while college students in Iowa are still on vacation, which means that young kids will be home in Iowa where they may be registered to vote, but college kids who may also be registered to vote there will not be on their campuses and thus not susceptible to the candidates. It's just a universe in which predicting who will come out is always hard. This year, it's particularly hard. So the fields on both sides are so big that it would be really impossible for me to thoroughly review them all, but I thought I would just quickly go over a couple of the leading contenders on both the Republican and Democratic side, so that we could have an avenue for jumping off place in questions, because I'm really most interested in hearing your questions. On the Republican side, it's one of the most unusual situations I can ever remember. There's no natural nominee among the entire field. There's no one who's a natural fit with the current Republican Party. And in fact, almost everybody has some presumably pretty severe and perhaps almost disqualifying problem. Start with Senator McCain. If you'd asked me a year ago today, standing at this podium, who would be the front runner for the Republican nomination, I'm sure I would have told you that it was he, even though he had a number of problems. But the collapse of his campaign was one of the most stunning developments of the last spring and summer. And watching the way what seemed to be his heavy early support and financial backing disappeared through a combination of mismanagement and overly rosy expectations, and the fact that a critical mass of the party's base never really liked him and doesn't like him any better today than they ever did. And his maverick impulses, which are the part that have made him appealing to many independents and, frankly, to many reporters, whom he often jokes are his natural base, has hurt him with the Republican electorate. And he seems to be struggling to get any traction at all, and it's hard to see how he will be able to go the distance. Rudy Giuliani, I know very well. I haven't spent a lot of time around him in recent years, but I covered both his campaigns for mayor, and I covered the beginning of his mayoralty in New York. I was even involved peripherally in covering some of his prosecutions as a U.S. attorney. He's one of the most interesting and also one of the most difficult public figures I've ever known. I think it's safe to say he is a very complicated personality, a very hard-charging personality, and in many ways a person to whom exposure does not breed fondness. I'm not a kind of reporter who likes to make predictions, but again, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have confidently predicted that Rudy Giuliani would never get this far in the presidential sweepstakes for his party because of his positions on the issues, his support for gay rights, his pro-choice position. It would seem to make him anathema to large swaths of the Republican electorate. And yet he has managed to keep going largely on the basis of strong national poll ratings that have helped him raise money and a rosy glow about 911. What people who didn't live in New York and aren't New Yorkers tend to forget is just how deeply unpopular he was in New York on September 10th, 2001. And I think it's safe to say that never before in American history have we had a major party candidate who divorced his second wife in a press conference, carried on an affair with the woman who became his third wife while apparently double billing his security expenses to the city of New York in a way that, on the face of it, looks suspicious, and who, at the risk of sounding, I want to say this carefully, I think he does not have a classic American temperament or character. He has a kind of authoritarian political temperament that is more likely to be found in other cultures than ours, in Latin cultures. And I think it would be really interesting to see how he wears in the course of a long campaign. My suspicion is he wouldn't wear that well. Now, at the moment, the challenge he's facing is he's not leading in the polls in either Iowa or New Hampshire. He's eager to get the campaign down to Florida, where there are a lot of New York retirees. The question is whether he can hang in there long enough to do that. Governor Huckabee. He's the big surprise of the moment. He's rising in the polls in Iowa. He's getting traction. He's getting a lot of national media attention. He, too, is a very unlikely candidate for the party in some ways, although the Republican religious right base is very attracted to him. But in other ways, he's a totally illogical fit for the modern Republican Party, and he seemed to be kind of a parochial figure from a small, relatively, you know, quote-unquote backward state. And I think the thing that people need to remember is 16 years ago, a lot of people thought Bill Clinton was a figure from a parochial backward state, too. And lately, the Democrats have taken to saying that they hope Huckabee does well because they think he'd be an attractive candidate in the general election. To that, I can only say the Democrats in 1980 thought Ronald Reagan would be the most desirable candidate to run against, too, and I think you better be careful what you wish for. In some ways, the most fascinating Republican candidate is the one who on paper seems best positioned to be standing when everyone else has fallen, and that's Governor Romney of Massachusetts. But he has other problems, including his remarkable string of inconsistencies on important issues. He has been all over every side of almost every issue, saying one thing when he was governor of Massachusetts or running against Senator Kennedy, saying quite another now when he's trying to appeal to the Republican base. I think eventually it will be hard for him to hold all those inconsistencies together, and he would be a opposition researcher's dream come true in terms of making negative campaign ads, or as the political professionals like to call them, comparative ads, when fall rolls around. He also has another interesting thing about his background that I think has not been fully tested in the American political marketplace, and that is his religion. One wants to be, again, very careful in talking about something so personal and deep as a person's faith. And I don't think most Americans would question Governor Romney's sincerity of belief or his right to hold the beliefs he holds. But the truth is, Mormonism is an unusual religion. It's not a run-of-the-mill religion. Many people among evangelical Christians do not consider it to be a true strain of Christianity. I have an unusual perspective on this because I grew up in Macomb, Illinois, which is about 20 miles from Carthage, Illinois, where the prophet Joseph Smith was actually murdered and by a lynch mob. And one of my scariest childhood visits, which was routinely made every fall, was to the jail in Carthage, where you could see carefully preserved under a piece of glass on the floor, bloodstained from a bullet that killed Joseph Smith, and the well into which his brother fell after they tried to escape from the jail. And it was quite a gory scene. And Nauvoo, which is where the Mormons had moved after coming from upstate New York, was at that time in the 1840s bigger than Chicago. And it was a thriving and, to some ways, to the rest of the population of central Illinois, very threatening presence. And it was the explosion that led to Joseph Smith's murder that prompted the Mormons to go across the Mississippi and ultimately to Missouri and then on to Salt Lake. So while not meaning the slightest disrespect for Governor Romney's religion, I do think, again, we've never had a candidate in American history who is running for president whose religion involves the appearance of golden tablets in upstate New York in the 1830s, and it's a little bit different than the appearance of, you know, an ark thousands of years ago in biblical history. And I think it's just an interesting question that will be tested again in the marketplace. On the Democratic side, it's even more interesting in some ways. It's very intense, and obviously the two leading contenders are Senator Clinton and Senator Obama. I don't mean to slight John Edwards, and it seemed for a while this summer that his campaign might catch fire. In fact, a year ago right now, I was having a conversation with one of Senator Clinton's longtime advisors, and he privately said that they were most worried about Senator Edwards' opposition. They thought that by virtue of his running for a second time, he would know much more about what he was doing, that he would have an appeal to a lot of the Democratic base by virtue of his emphasis on the two Americas, that he was a skilled candidate, that he was appealing, attractive, youthful, forward-looking, and so on. For whatever reason, he has not been able to get that much traction, and obviously a big part of the reason is that Senator Obama has taken up the excitement of the new and the different. Part of the reason that I think Mayor Giuliani will have trouble is part of the same reason that Mrs. Clinton may well have trouble, and that is if this election is really about change, neither one of them represents change in the purest sense. Most of the pollsters do say that the election is shaping up at this moment in the public soundings as one of change, and Mayor Giuliani is in some ways President Bush plus two in terms of the intensity factor, in terms of the willingness to exercise untrammeled authority. I think we don't have any idea what we might see if Mayor Giuliani became president and exercised wide latitude over some of these discretionary questions in the war on terror, for example. I think he might make President Bush look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm in some ways. And at the same time, Mrs. Clinton can't really plausibly say that she is something wholly new under the sun. She can say that she's experienced, although her experience is at least partly derivative, and it's not the same thing to have been the first lady as to have been the president. All that being said, she does have intimate knowledge of what is a very small club. She knows what it's like to be in the White House and in the middle of a media maelstrom. She hasn't made any mistakes, really, until very recently when she seemed to be a little panicky and latched on to Senator Obama's allegedly intense ambition in kindergarten. That leaves aside the question of when, how long and intense her own ambition has been. But, I mean, it's a little unsporting to go. If you have to go back to kindergarten to find something negative to say about something, you have to, you're working pretty hard. But she has been cool under fire. She has, at every point, kept coming. When Senator Obama was briefly beating her in the fundraising sweepstakes, she came back and bested him. She's extremely disciplined. She's an extremely linear thinker. She doesn't make unforced errors or casual misjudgments. She's also done something that's, to me, a little bit remarkable, and that is almost through a sheer act of will in recent months, she's made herself a more appealing personality. She's looser on the stump. She's funnier. I had the occasion to see her not long ago at a forum organized by Jim Wallace, who's the kind of lefty evangelical Christian leader in Washington. And this was a forum at which all the Democratic candidates appeared. And you might have expected Senator Obama to knock it out of the park. In fact, he was somewhat wordy and got down into legalistic questions about programs for childhood education. Senator Clinton spoke openly and earnestly about her faith. And the moderator, Soledad O'Brien, was trying to rattle her, I think, a little bit by asking her questions about President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky and other things. And she asked Mrs. Clinton what she prayed for. She said, "Oh, I pray for all sorts of things, Soledad. I sometimes say, dear Lord, why can't I lose weight? And then I think that's a trivial thing to pray about." And I saw on that stage an engaging, earnestly, genuinely funny Mrs. Clinton that I'd very seldom seen in my days covering the White House. I think part of that comfort derives from the fact that she is at long last in these 7 years in the Senate, 6 years now, acting on her own account, accountable to her own constituency, and she is the one who's in charge of the situation. And she has, by all accounts, been an almost model senator. She's worked the chamber. She's worked both sides of the aisle. She's made friends with the old bulls and tried to show them respect, and she's received respect in turn. She hasn't been a showboater. She hasn't been a show-off. I mean, she's running for president, but so is half the Senate. So so that's not necessarily a black mark against her. I think it's safe to say that the single most fascinating figure of the whole year, and certainly right of these past couple weeks, is Senator Obama. I actually spent a lot of time last winter and spring writing a long piece about Senator Obama, which has yet to run in Vanity Fair, and it may never run unless he wins in Iowa. But so I selfishly hope he does at least well enough in Iowa to get this in the March issue. And but one of the things, the piece was really focused entirely on his childhood and youth, and it really ends the moment he gave the speech at the Boston Convention. And one of the things that I learned in that piece is that Mrs. Clinton's criticism is right in one sense, that Senator Obama has been a much more ambitious, much tougher, much more calculating, in the good sense of calculating, person than he presents himself to be. He told his brother-in-law nearly 20 years ago that he hoped he could run for president someday. He seemed, despite a certain period of youthful wandering, which he recounts very effectively in his book, to have seized on his destiny at some fairly early age, and certainly by the time he got out of Columbia and went to Chicago and embarked on his career in social work, he knew that the traditional career paths, the easy career paths that would have been available to him as a star black student, were not really for him. When he came back to Chicago as the first black president of the Harvard Law Review and didn't want to take a job at a big law firm, but instead went to practice in a smaller public service firm and then got involved in, registering voters, teaching law at the University of Chicago, and ultimately campaigning himself, He clearly passed up all sorts of opportunities that would have been a more typical career escalator. When I talk to people who knew him well as a child, his fifth grade teacher, his mother's PhD thesis advisor at the University of Hawaii, if you're sensing a good trip in there, you're probably right, but they uniformly spoke of his kind of inner core of steel. He was raised mostly by his maternal grandparents, who were from Kansas, but who had taken a big adventure and gone to Hawaii on the eve of statehood, and whose only daughter had married the first African exchange student in the history of the University of Hawaii, and they accepted him. Soon enough, he left the family, and you know the story. He went back to Africa. He ultimately fathered a total of 8 children by 4 different women, at least 2 of them at the same time. And one of the things Senator Obama told me quite poignantly was that in some ways he was lucky not to have grown up in his father's house because it was probably a pretty dysfunctional place. His mother was a person of great intensity, great feeling. She was open to the world. The other funny thing he told me was that he had to laugh at these stories about how his stepfather was a Muslim who tried to indoctrinate him in the ways of that faith. He said his stepfather was the most pro-American man in Indonesia who worked for Sun Oil Company, listened to Andy Williams records, and liked to sip Johnny Walker Black after he got back from the tennis court. And in fact, part of the problem with his mother's marriage to this man was she became steadily more and more Javanese in her outlook, and he became steadily more and more American. So I think one of the things to remember about him, and our friend Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Lincoln is instructive in this regard. Everyone thought in the 1860 election that there were so many more qualified, more experienced people who should be president, who would be president. Some of them thought that the person who got the nomination was decidedly unqualified. And it's hard to remember in the wake of the Lincoln we know now, whose bicentennial will come up next year, that the Lincoln to whom Senator Obama could plausibly be compared is not the Lincoln of the second inaugural or the Lincoln Memorial. He's the circuit-riding prairie lawyer in John Ford's Young Mr. Lincoln or Robert E. Sherwood's Abraham Lincoln in Illinois, which was produced on the eve of World War II on Broadway and summoned up the notion of this intensely ambitious young man who dared to run for the state legislature after he just moved to New Salem. And he lost, but he got more votes than anybody else in his newly adopted hometown. So I think when you think of Senator Obama in that context, it makes a lot more sense. And you understand the kind of intensity of ambition that got him as far as he is. And I must say it was quite striking to hear Oprah Winfrey on the radio the other day in South Carolina invoking Dr. King and saying that, you know, Dr. King summoned Americans to the dream and that African Americans in particular no longer had to dream the dream. They could live the dream. So whatever one thinks about Senator Obama's qualifications or preparedness to be president, there's something remarkable in our politics that has produced him. And I think he's by far the most interesting person I've seen in politics in a long time. He almost deliberately fires down a crowd and tries to get it to listen and think instead of feel. And that's a challenge. I think by the clock, it looks as if I'm running out of the formal time here, but I think we have a lot of time for questions, and I'd be happy to try to answer any that you have.
I would like to start it off, Todd, by asking you to follow up on something you opened with, and that is how the role of the press was significant in giving us the system we presently have. But hasn't the compression of the caucus and primary season really increased the importance of the role that the press has as a filter? There's much less opportunity for people around the country now to really see the candidates up close and personal. In Charlottesville, we've been blessed by having visits from several of them, but there are only so many days and there are only so many cities that they can go to. And so most of us do depend on you and your colleagues in the press to size these people up for us. What does that level of really increased responsibility do to the way you, as a reporter, try to look at these people?
Well, in short answer to your question, yes, I do think the influence of the press has been increased. And I'm sorry to say this because I've never had any job in any other field. I don't think that's a good thing for American democracy. And I don't think the press is particularly capable of exercising that influence in a wise way. I think there's too much focus on who's up, who's down, The nature of journalism is all about the aberrant and the exceptional and not the typical. And I like to say sometimes that newspapers are good about telling you what happened, but we're pretty bad about telling you what's happening. And television's even worse in a way, because the reality of life in Charlottesville is that you all woke up this morning and drove here and thought it was a wonderfully warm day and are worried about whether there'll be an ice storm this weekend. And, paying your children's tuition, but it looks like most of you have managed to do that. But that's what I'm worried about every morning. And the truth is, often that doesn't get captured in the stories about politics. And I would never substitute the judgment of, you know, the editors of major newspapers and the producers of major networks for the judgment of voters all over the country, one by one by one. And the truth is, there just isn't enough time for people to have that chance to think about it. I don't think anybody in Iowa, New Hampshire, except the most committed few, are really thinking very deeply right now about the caucuses and primary. They're thinking about buying their Christmas presents and their air travel plans and all the rest of it. And the notion that there was briefly, as you know, a possibility that the New Hampshire primary would take place in December. And if that happens, we might as well just have the presidential election a year early. And, you know, it's really crazy. And I wonder, you know, there is in every cycle some pushback about, and I just have to wonder if in 2012 there won't be some pretty profound pushback to say, let's just slow this down a little bit. My suspicion is it'll be even faster, but I'd like to think that somebody would say, let's slow it down.
What is the impact that the second and third tier candidates have on the process? Would it be better for the process if we thin these people out of the debates and said anybody who's not showing 8 or 10% or something in the polls would not be invited to participate? Or do the Dennis Kuciniches and Tom Dodds and so on make a valuable contribution just by hanging in there?
You know, I'm very torn about that question, George, because I think you could argue that there'd be a clearer discussion if the minor candidates, so-called, were not in these debates, for example. On the other hand, if we had a parliamentary system, Senators Dodd and Biden would almost certainly be the leading contenders for the presidency. They have the most experience. I mean, they wake up in the morning and think that the reason they're in the race, apart from they can get maybe more attention for the ideas they care about, but they're really in the race because at some fundamental level they wake up in the morning and think they could do a better job than the other people, that they know more about how it works. Let's not forget, Senator Biden's been in the Senate for 35 years now. And so I think their voices are valuable, and it's interesting to hear them. The question becomes, you can't have an effective debate with eight people. You can't even really have an effective serial discussion with eight people. And there's not enough time for follow-up and follow-through, and it's a lot of kind of back-and-forth silly season. But again, I'm torn on that question because I think you have to be careful about cutting off other voices where they deserve to be heard.
My name's Lisa Aronson. Thank you very much. I appreciated your comments. I noticed you were emphasizing the temperament more than the positions of the candidates. I'm interested in that point of view with respect to the victory of one candidate over the other.
I guess I did that in part because, I mean, there are sharp differences between the Democrats and the Republicans over policy questions, but there aren't really pronounced differences between Senator Clinton, Senator Edwards, and Senator Obama on questions of policy. They want to make you think there are great big differences between their health care plans, and there are some differences around the margin, but there aren't fundamental disagreements. The same is true, I think, there aren't really fundamental disagreements over most questions among the Republicans, even though they want to try to make you think there is. I also think that in presidential politics, more than in almost any other kind of race, temperament, character, personality does play a large role. I think it's beyond dispute that the temperament and personality of George W. Bush versus that of Al Gore played a perhaps dispositive role in 2000, for example. I think if you had just seen these people on paper, I think there might have been a different result if you hadn't seen all the body language and kind of personality quirks of each. And another thing, frankly, if President Bush had been more candid, then Governor Bush, had been more candid about the kinds of policies he actually intended to pursue, I think that also might have had a different outcome because he wound up governing in a markedly different way than he campaigned. He campaigned as a uniter. He governed really in some ways proudly as a divider. I mean, saying, you know, you're for me or against me. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to behave, but it's not the way he said he would behave. And I think that's interesting to keep in mind.
There was an interesting column in the New York Times yesterday setting up the thesis that next year's election is more likely to be a quote-unquote post-war election rather than a wartime one.
So the question is, who's our Clement Attlee? This is David Brooks's column.
Pardon?
The question is, who's our Clement Attlee? Who would be the post-war?
Yeah, that's right. Attlee versus Churchill thing, and they said that this would be because the reduction of the danger of a nuclear weapon in Iran and somewhat reduced importance of the war in Iraq as a most important issue, and they proposed that Hillary Clinton would have less of a chance than, and Rudy Giuliani would have less of a chance than Barack Obama and the gentleman from Arkansas. What do you think of this thesis?
I think that's a very plausible thesis. I mean, it's, again, risky because we're probably one terrorist attack away from feeling that we're on a sort of wartime footing again. But one of the challenges of this particular post-911 environment has been that the administration says in its rhetoric that we're at war and we're not sparing any effort. But from living here as an American, that's not how it really feels to be a citizen these days. You're not being asked to sacrifice much of anything. You're not being asked to pay higher taxes at the federal level. You're not being asked to conduct scrap drives, or you're asked to fly and buy. And I think that to sustain the level of intensity in the face of that is hard. I think the Iraq war is still obviously incredibly important, and it will be the principal task of the next president, whoever he or she is, to untangle that. And I have no doubt that a Republican or a Democrat will essentially begin to untangle it. The only question is whether, as with President Nixon, it will take, you know, 4 or more years to untangle it is the real question, but it will be done.
My name is Tim Hulbert. I live here in Charlottesville. With the compression of the primary season and with this jumble of no clear leader, is it possible or even likely that perhaps this selection process may go back to the time when the selection was actually occurring at a convention? And I would suggest that that could happen in both parties. And what do you think about that?
From your lips to God's ears, it would be my fondest wish, my most fervent prayer, and the dream of every journalist living, I think. It is mathematically quite possible that it could happen. The things would have to break just right, but it is possible that both sides could get to early March with essentially no one with enough delegates to win. Another thing I forgot to say about the Iowa caucuses, they don't select a single delegate. They begin the process that goes to the state party, that goes to the state, that eventually selects the delegates. But no delegates will be selected on January 3rd. So I think it would be wonderful for democracy and for a lot of things if they were horse trading and swapping and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And if somebody promised this or that to be the vice president, I think it would be great. I mean, the record of American history is that it worked pretty well for most of the time that's how it happened. And I think you could argue that, you know, it hasn't necessarily worked better in the past 45 years in which that's the way it doesn't happen. So I always say that my colleague Karen Tumulty at Time Magazine was recently interviewed by the Texas Monthly, which is her home state, and she said that she's had the bad luck over the past 10 years of thinking every story she's in the middle of is the biggest story of her lifetime. Impeachment, she thought nothing could top that. And then, you know, the recount, she thought nothing could top that. 9/11, nothing could top that. I mean, a brokered convention would be fantastic. So,
I enjoyed your comments very much, Mr. Fordham. You talked about the impact of the press on the elections. I would like to ask you what you think of the impact of the internet is going to be. For example, I received all kinds of vicious and vile attacks on Obama all the time, about his being raised as a Muslim, hardline Muslim, going to a right-wing, fanatical Muslim grade school and so forth, and that he's secretly in this race just to spread give the Muslims another attack on the United States. What kind of impact do you think that is going to have on the election?
Well, I think those particular things may well have a pronounced impact, and I think the internet in general is already, you know, having a pronounced impact. We saw in 2004 how much it helped Governor Dean raise money and how much it helped him network with supporters. So in some ways, that was a really powerful lesson that all the campaigns have emulated. They don't forget, both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama effectively announced their candidacies over the internet in streaming video. Everyone has such bandwidth now that they felt safe in being able to do that. So I think we've yet to see the end of that, both as an organization tool, a fundraising tool, a persuading tool. It used to be that a long time ago, if campaigns wanted to get out nasty messages about their opponents that weren't particularly traceable, they could do them through direct mail. They would run radio ads, which would be heard but not so traceable as television ads. Now they can clearly do direct hits through email and other internet techniques. And in my working life as a journalist, which is now 26 years, the internet is the one truly new thing under the sun. There used to be a rule at the New York Times that you could never say anything was unprecedented because the theory was there was always some precedent somewhere, some aspect of a precedent for some event. But the internet is completely new in my experience in both the way it challenges the prevailing business model of daily journalism and facilitates, at its best, the work of journalists. There's no more waiting around for a bulky UPS package or a cloudy fax, or, you know, you don't have to come to Charlottesville to take the resources of the Miller Center and use them. You can use them all the time on the web and in real time. And that's a profound change. And I think that's the good part of what you talk about. The other part is very troubling in some ways.
Early on in your speech, you addressed the topic of fundraising for campaigns. Do you have any insight on the problem of bundling and illegal funding?
You know, not any profound insight that you probably don't have yourself, but it is a problem. My own personal view about campaign finance reform is pretty simple. Unless the Supreme Court overturns Buckley against Vallejo, which was the landmark decision that said that political donations are intrinsic to free speech and can't really be limited, or unless there's some kind of a national law passed mandating free television time for all candidates who have a certain level of qualification, I don't see what you can really do about it. And I think in some ways a saner course for us, rather than try to build in this complicated system of incentives and disincentives and matching money and all, would be to have requirements, very stringent requirements, for instantaneous, real-time internet disclosure in a way that makes bundling apparent. So the answer is sunlight, not Rube Goldberg. And I mean, I do think the experience over the past 30 years with campaign finance has been that every time there's been a reform, there's a cottage industry in Washington, not even a cottage industry, a pretty big industry, dedicated solely to figuring out how to get around it. And, you know, you don't have to be a cynic to feel pretty depressed about the fact that, you know, this year began with even the biggest supporter of campaign finance reform, Senator McCain, joining everyone else in saying he was not, now he is because he needs the money, but that he was not going to abide by the fundraising caps because he wanted to do the Bush model and raise as much money as he could. So I don't think there's any real, Fred Wertheimer would shoot me for saying this, and he's a wonderful guy, but I don't think there's any answer except disclosure, and that can be prompt and immediate now.
The past experience with a third-party candidate being Ross Perot some years ago just seemed to reinforce the idea that a third-party candidate, independent candidate, could have a chance in the election process as we know it. Newsweek ran recently, a very insightful article on Michael Bloomberg in New York. And Michael Bloomberg has all the money in the world to do this independently. And it was thought that perhaps he would go if his staff determined that after the primaries, the caucuses and all those incidents, if there was the survivors of the process were still measured as such as being unsatisfactory in the general populace, which is highly likely because I don't think anybody in either party stands out as a viable candidate right now going in, that Michael Bloomberg might throw his hat into the ring. And what do you think of that? And would he have a chance? Should he do so?
I think that's one of those questions like the brokered convention. I think it would be fascinating if he did. I remember well the period in 1992 when it when it did suddenly seem to a lot of supposedly smart people that Ross Perot had a real chance. He certainly affected that election. There's no doubt about that. So I think the short answer is, if he chose to run, I think Mayor Bloomberg could be a very powerful force. He would have some deficits, but he'd also have a lot. Some of his very deficits are his advantages, his kind of chameleon-like party status. He's really a Democrat who became a Republican because it was easier for him to get the Republican nomination in New York than it was to get the Democratic nomination. But on most national issues, he's a kind of moderate, fiscally conservative Democrat. He has the money, and he would presumably be willing to spend even more money than Mr. Perot did. And I think it would be a fascinating dynamic. Because one of the realities, I forgot to say this in talking about Mrs. Clinton earlier, there are two things that haven't been tested about her. One is a critical mass of Americans simply can't stand her. And that has been less important for her so far in the Democratic primary because a large mass of the Democratic primary electorate loves her. But in the national electorate at large, there's a point above which she simply will never be able to go, presumably, in terms of her approval. And the second thing that has yet to be really, really thoroughly tested with her is the question of whether the country wants to have 28 years of two families on national tickets, and whether we really want to embrace a kind of dynastic politics of Bush, Clinton, Clinton, Bush, back and forth, and also how we would deal with a figure who would, you know, become the first laddie, and what he would, how he would play in Peoria, and how he would actually function as the spouse of the President of the United States. And I think that's a question that, you know, a lot of people wonder about.
My question has to do with terms of address. At some point in the media, a decision had to be made about what to call Hillary Clinton. Senator, Ms. or Mrs., can you enlighten us on the process that you went through and what might have happened, let's say, at the New York Times, that Mrs. won out?
Well, the New York Times...
Further, and does that carry a certain connotation?
It's complicated, and it's funny that you ask that, because my wife, I'll put a little pitch here, has just written a book, which is coming out in February for HarperCollins, called Why Women Should Rule the World. And I'm probably Exhibit A, but she talks in there about her own difficulty in deciding what to call Senator Clinton in her book, because she was introduced to her 16 years ago as Hillary. That's what she called her. That's what she would still call her if she ran into her in person. But, you know, she said the minute she won, she would be Madam President for the rest of her life. In the case of the New York Times, the rules are incredibly Byzantine, but here's the basic bottom line. For many years, the New York Times would not use the word Ms. because the longtime editor, Abe Rosenthal, felt it was politically charged, and its mere use signified a kind of political statement. He persisted in this view despite intensive lobbying from Gloria Steinem and Barbara Walters and Beverly Sills and lots of his prominent women friends in New York. And finally, one day, almost as arbitrarily as he had had the other position, he relented and said that it had entered the culture, and Gloria Steinem sent him a big bouquet, and all was right with the world. But even when the Times allowed the use of Ms., it still required its reporters, and to this day I believe it still does, to ascertain the preference of the person. In other words, you were not supposed to assign Ms. to a person whose marital status you knew unless she requested the use of Ms. So you were not reflexively to call someone Ms. without her assent. And in fact, this caused from some hilarious moments of, you know, late night requirements of calling a person and asking her preference. If the only time you could do it is if it was kind of a man on the street interview and you hadn't been able to ascertain the person's marital status, and then you were usually taken to task for not having done so. So it became really elaborate. The first reference for any senator in the New York Times is always Senator. The second reference is always Mr. And I believe that in the case of Mrs. Clinton, because I believe that was established when she was the first lady, that she was given the chance of being Ms. Clinton or Mrs. Clinton. And I think I'm correct in saying this, that she chose Mrs. Clinton herself, and that has endured. I think she would be entitled to be called Ms. Clinton in the New York Times if she wished. Jean Kirkpatrick always wanted to be called Dr. Kirkpatrick. Madeleine Albright likes to be called Dr. Albright, I think. I'm getting confused about some of these things here and there. But in the case of the New York Times, she does have a vote, and I think that's her vote.
I'm Bill Dunn, a retired lawyer. In your excellent talk, among the Republican candidates, you did not mention Congressman Ron Paul, initially a rank outsider, but who in occasions like the Republican debate attracted more favorable comment for what he had to say than anybody else. What do you think of him?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting questions that goes back to George's question about whether the so-called minor candidates should be in the debates. You're absolutely right about Ron Paul attracting that kind of attention, which is, in fact, what finally began to happen with Governor Huckabee. He, too, attracted that kind of attention. He was initially dismissed as a, you know, non-starter, and he began attracting kind of attention in the debates, in public forums, on the ground in Iowa. So that's why I'm reluctant to shut off those kinds of discussions, because I think a person like Ron Paul deserves to be heard, and he does have interesting ideas. And you know, personally, it's always a little unnerving when you find yourself in these debates agreeing with the most fringy person. Sometimes Congressman Kucinich makes eminent good sense, you know, not always, but sometimes he says something. And certainly Ron Paul is the same kind of thing. Mike Gravel on the Democratic side often says very commonsensical things, and it's refreshing to hear them. And the truth is, the so-called minor candidates have the liberty to say the unvarnished truth in ways that their rivals who are more eagerly pursuing the prize don't.
I want to ask you if you think that Oprah Winfrey's support of Obama will make much of a difference.
It's a really good question. Dee Dee was just reminding me the other day that traditionally celebrity endorsements don't make very much difference. Mostly people just discount them as, you know, preaching to the choir in a way. What makes her particularly interesting is that as a phenomenon, she is almost unprecedented in American life, and her influence over book buyers and image makers, and in fact, her influence over the kind of course of the way people campaign in America, by bearing their souls and telling about their childhoods and so forth, is pretty hard to overstate. So I don't know. I think it's something to watch. And as Dee Dee said, you know, 6 months from now, it'll all seem incredibly clear that, you know, her endorsement made a huge difference or made no difference or actually hurt him, which is, I guess, conceivable, although she's done it in such an open-hearted way, it doesn't seem like there's a... I think, you know, I just don't see how it could really hurt him too much, but... It's an interesting question to see whether it really helps him.
Hi, I'm here representing women, but when I get asked, I usually choose doctor. So I'm Dr. Kotcheris. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I was going to ask a similar question about Obama, but I'd like to follow it up with, could you say something about what I've heard is that perhaps Obama's trying to position himself to be the vice presidential candidate, perhaps with Clinton, or what do you see about the whole vice presidential?
And that's an interesting question. I mean, I suppose at some level, no one wants to admit this, but everybody who runs for president always has to have in the back of the mind that history has shown that, you know, pretty often the odds are that, you know, if you don't get the job, that you would be a contender for the... I think given the level of apparent tension between them, it would be unlikely for Senator Clinton to pick Senator Obama. I think also, because Senator Clinton herself would be facing an enormous, unprecedented, there I go again, hurdle of being, you know, the first female candidate, I think she might think that's an awful lot to pile into one package, you know, first female, first black candidate. And I think she might be inclined to look for someone like Governor Richardson of New Mexico, or even your own Governor Kaine, or Senator Warner, the Mark Warner. It's Governor Warner. Sorry. He wanted. Maybe he will be. But in any case, Senator John Warner would be a perfectly good vice president too. But that might be. She wants some balance on that and some ballast of a person who had, you know, state house experience, something like that.
Well, that was my question, but I do have another question. What do you think about the tendency of the press to take one comment that a person makes and blow it out of proportion and really ruin the person by one comment? I'm thinking George Allen and the Macaca comment, or Howard Dean and the rant. And it seems like these people's are, you know, we're going to get such sanitized candidates, and we're not going to really know who we're dealing with because of the tendency of the press to take one comment and run with it and really ruin that person's...
Well, the long answer is, I think sometimes those comments get traction because they seem to to sail right into what's already a perceived vulnerability of the person. But the shorter answer is, I think it's terrible. I think it's really unfair. And it's one of the great burdens that I've been relieved of by not being in daily journalism anymore. Having the time to think about what really matters, not what matters tonight for the news, but what might matter 6 months from now, has been very liberating. And I mean, the thought of having to be out there writing these stories about something that's obviously a slip or obviously a miscalculation, there's so much energy, so much ink and pixels and airtime spent on stuff that really is doggy do, frankly, you know, and it won't matter. So I don't think that's a good thing.
Hello, I'm Margaret Hart, and I've read your column for, not your column, but your articles for years in the New York Times. They were superb. My question concerns, how can we shorten the primary and the election process? Is this something the United States Senate has to take up, or the national political parties, or the state legislatures? Can anything be done?
The two places where it would have to happen would be the national parties and the state legislatures. But you see that those have been at cross purposes this year because, I'm going to get this wrong, but I want to say Florida and at least one other state move their primaries up in violation of the wishes of the Democratic National Committee. And Michigan, is that the other one? And so those delegations are at risk of not being seated at the convention. There could be a national commission that would make recommendations. Then it might be hard to get the parties to agree because one might think that one was advantaged by having a prolonged schedule. But I wish something could be done about it. But it's not really susceptible. So many things in American life, education, insurance, and elections are basically creatures of state state law and state legislatures, and you'd have to do it state by state. And you'd have to persuade the governors and legislatures that it's not in their interest to rush it.
Todd Burdum, we thank you very much for shedding so much light.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.